Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Roger Schwelt. Roger is an American quadruple board certified medical doctor who resides in Loma Linda, California. He has board certifications in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine. Roger also runs the incredibly successful YouTube channel MedCram, where he provides unmatched medical education for free. His educational platform is used by hospitals, medical schools, and hundreds of thousands of medical professionals from all over the world. Roger has been at the forefront of medical professionals who are rediscovering the power of sunlight in medicine. He has been an important thought leader sharing the powerful effects of light on biology, particularly those only found in sunlight. He has also used his platform to inform the public about the dangers of the current artificial lighting fixtures, rich in short visible wavelengths and not balanced by those longer red and near-infrared wavelengths. It was such an honor to speak with Roger as he epitomizes what a medical doctor should be: curious, open-minded, and patient-focused. He continues to be a vital voice in this renaissance of light medicine in a world so consumed by the whims of the pharmaceutical industries. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share my deep dives into topics like this. It's the best way to support me and the podcast while also getting my in-depth thoughts about these podcast topics. The link to this is in the episode notes. With all this being said, I really hope you enjoy the episode. Roger, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. It's such a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with someone who's got so much experience and who has such a big impact, due to your YouTube channel. I mean, I'm sure that most people, at least peripherally, know who you are. So I guess I'd love to get a bit of a background. I know you're quadruple board certified, which is quite an unusual thing. So how did you start your journey and end up here?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I didn't know I was going to do medicine. I just, sort of went along and sort of got interested in along the way. So, you know, I went to undergrad, did a bachelor's in chemistry and biology. And the friends that I met there were interested in doing pre-med. So I sort of went along with that and did 4 years of medical school after that at Loma Linda University in Southern California, and stayed on there and did internal medicine residency, which is basically a residency where you are dealing with the medical aspects of the internal organs of the body. You pretty much have to do a residency in internal medicine to be able to be any kind of subspecialist. So pulmonologist, cardiologist, nephrologist, gastroenterologist, allergist, infectious disease specialist, all of those are sort of subspecialties of medicine. So that's a 3-year residency. And then I did a chief year of chief residency at a local county hospital, and came back to Loma Linda, did another 3 years of pulmonary critical care medicine. So in essence, to be a pulmonologist and a critical care specialist, you have to be boarded in pulmonary, you have to be boarded in critical care, and you have to have done 3 years of internal medicine. So it's not unusual for pulmonologists to be triple boarded. The unusual aspect of what I did was, after I graduated from the fellowship, which was another 3 years, I did a working rotation that allowed me to grandfather in and take the examination for sleep medicine. So that was about a year or so, and I completed that too. So my practice is in Southern California. I see patients full time in the hospital, in the critical care setting, in the clinic, and I do pulmonary work and sleep work there, and I'm also a faculty appointment at Loma Linda and UCR, which is University of California, Riverside. And of course, co-founder of MedCram.com, where we do continuing medical education classes, and also have a YouTube channel where we talk about the latest medical issues and educate the lay public on that. The latest thing that I've sort of become really interested in is the benefits of sunlight, because it's so easy to do. And also because there's a lot of benefits, and I think we're missing out on those benefits.
How did you start MedCram? What was the inspiration for that?
So when I was in my new job, part of my new job was actually getting PA students. So these are physician assistant students on the rotation from Loma Linda University. And one of them was Kyle Allred. So he came to the rotation. I was also doing didactic lectures for the PA students. And the one I was assigned to do was acid base. And instead of showing up to the lecture hall with a PowerPoint presentation chock full of words that were going through a mile a minute and telling people to memorize things that they didn't understand, I showed up with a whiteboard and a marker, and we went through and we talked and discussed, kind of like in a Khan Academy style, acid-base physiology, which for those who are in the medical field will know that acid-base physiology is not intuitive, on the surface at least. You've got to sort of get into it. The numbers can be confusing. And if you explain it really well, people can understand it, grasp it. It's really something quite amazing when you grasp it. So he was impressed, I guess, with that lecture and had an idea that there is a real need out there for medicine to be explained in a clear, understandable way. And his father was actually involved with medical education. He's now taken over some of that aspect as well. So we founded a simple YouTube channel in 2012. Which is called MedCram videos on the YouTube channel. And our first video was on acid-base physiology, and we just went from there. By the time we hit the pandemic, we got up to about 400,000 subscribers. We had started a website. We were getting CME accreditation. And actually now our videos are being used all over the world, in medical schools and other institutions privately. We also have publishers that use our videos. So it's really been quite a journey, and I'm blessed by people who come up to me all the time and say, hey, you got me through, you know, respiratory therapy school, or you got me through medical school, or you got me through dental school, things of that nature. So that's where that came from.
It's an extremely useful resource, and I think some of the most popular videos are the ones talking about the power of light and particularly the near-infrared portion. How did you become exposed to these ideas about how powerful light was on biology?
Well, I have to admit, it wasn't something that I was thinking about. It was sort of tossed onto me when the pandemic came. You know, these patients that were coming in to the hospital, because I'm the critical care director or the critical care specialist on at the time. And all of these patients were coming in with COVID-19. We had never seen anything like this. We had to create a new ICU that was just for COVID. We doubled our capacity. Instead of our regular rotation that we were doing, where we would be working 80 hours a week and then take a week off for a break, we were working straight through because someone had to take care of these patients. And I began to ask questions. Why are these patients so sick? And why is it particularly people who are obese and people who have metabolic problems that are the ones that are the sickest? And why is it that that people that are coming in that have good vitamin D levels doing relatively well, and people that have low vitamin D levels are not doing well? And you know, the obvious thing that we did at the very beginning, obviously knowing that association does not mean causation, was that we were giving people vitamin D supplementation, pretty high doses of it, and there were some studies that seemed to indicate that it worked, and some studies that indicate that it didn't work as well as we would have expected it to, if that was really the issue. So I began to dig deeper, and to make a long story short, the metabolic aspect tied very nicely into mitochondria, and the fact that the mitochondria, as it seems, is sort of central to all of this, as we'll talk about with pulmonary physiology, and then the fact that sunlight exposure can really enhance mitochondrial function, and finally coming along to the lines of understanding and perhaps proposing that vitamin D may be doing some lifting, may be doing some work here, and I supplement with vitamin D. I'm not going to dis supplementation with vitamin D because I think it does have its benefits. There's no question about it. But I believe it's also a marker of people who are out in the sun. So people who have higher vitamin D levels may be out in the sun getting infrared light, and it may be that that is helping with patients with COVID-19. And I think now, and we'll talk about the data perhaps, that I'm fairly convinced that that is exactly what's going on.
The more I've spoken to researchers in the field, the more I'm beginning to think that vitamin D really is a small part of the benefit that you get from being outside with your skin exposed to natural light. And I think you're right that the vitamin D levels, when you look at the epidemiology, the people with the highest levels always do better. But again, like you said, it's a proxy marker. It's just telling you that these people are outdoors more, which I think is just, you know, a really easy way to tell if someone's, you know, living a life that's more aligned with the way that human beings should be living. And I recently wrote an article that basically points out that, you know, we know so little really, and the unknown unknowns are so much greater than what we know. And that really the only way to incorporate unknown unknowns is to sort of try and mimic and observe nature.
Yeah.
Because in nature, the unknown unknowns are already baked in. You don't have to think about it. You know, our ancestors weren't thinking, oh, what's my vitamin D level? They didn't have to, because it's baked into the way that you have to live. And I think that's what's so powerful about this sunlight story, is that you don't have to know what's going on precisely. You just have to recognize that that's the way we lived, you know, all of the time up until, you know, the last several decades when we mass migrated indoors under LED and fluorescent tubes. So it very much makes sense.
Yeah, no, what you just said right there, I think it encapsulates a lot of the issues that we have today with science. And it's this reductionistic understanding that we have to pick apart things to find out what they're doing. And the fallacy with reductionism in that sense is that we're completely negating the idea that things interact with each other and have a gestalt effect. In other words, the definition of gestalt is the idea that the sum of the parts are greater, the total is greater than the sum of its parts. And it very well may be that infrared light, when mixed with ultraviolet light in just the right way at just the right time of the day, is doing something different than either of those parts individually by themselves. And we have many examples of that, by the way, not just in sunlight. Speaking of lungs, many years ago, we observed that people who had diets that were rich in vitamin E, vitamin A, carotenoids, beta carotene, like carrots and fruits and vegetables and things of that nature, did better in lung cancer. So what did we do as scientists? We decided to say, well, maybe it's these antioxidants that people are consuming that's beneficial, these aromatic antioxidants. If you look at vitamin E and vitamin A, these are fat-soluble vitamins. So what do? They purified it, they extracted it, they processed it, they gave it in high doses in a randomized controlled fashion. And sure enough, what happened? Those patients that got these supplements actually did worse than the control groups. So again, another example would be fruits and fruit juices. We have good data that shows that whole fruits that are combined with fiber and digested as such, the way that it was nature intended when we bite into an apple or a fruit, that consuming fruit in that fashion is actually protective of diabetes, whereas juicing it and getting rid of the fiber and extracting the sugars and having it readily available in fruit juices does a completely different number on our insulin secretion than does eating the whole fruit. So this idea of reductionism, where you can simply find the active ingredient in something and extract it and then give it, there are some fallacies that we have to be careful of there, that we may miss out on the whole benefit. And then the last point that I'll make, and sort of we'll maybe come back to this at the end of today's talk, is, you know, with all of this discovery that we're about to talk about, with all of these studies that we're about to show, and all of these things that we're going to discuss, with all of the scientific accoutrements that we have now to test this stuff, I thought this was all new. And if you look back to Florence Nightingale in the 1850s, another health reformer here in the United States, Ellen G. White, who looked at these things, they were very certain that getting out into full light, fresh air, sunlight, they could see the difference. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't understand what was happening, but they could see a dramatic difference in how the patients improved when they were put under the sun, as opposed to when they were put inside into dark rooms, et cetera.
I think what you mentioned about the reductionistic idea is so important. And I just finished writing a piece about that Lancet trial that used the beta carotene supplements that I believe was ended early because of the trial group was actually doing so much worse that they figured it was unethical. But it's exactly right. And I saw a paper the other day where these photobiomodulation researchers were like, "Oh, we found new wavelengths in the infrared that are, you know, that are beneficial." And I thought, you know, in 50 years, we're going to have scientists that have realized that all the wavelengths in sunlight are beneficial, and that the perfect ratio of all of those is exactly what the sun looks like. I can tell you that now. Yeah, but it's, you know, the way that science works is you have to go, you know, one by one and sort of figure it out like that. When if you just stand back and go, well, we evolved to our environment and that's what our environment is. So it just seems quite obvious. And you mentioned the mitochondria before, and it's not surprising that anything that is sort of communicating with the mitochondria, the way that these long wavelengths are, you're going to have broad beneficial effects. It's not going to just affect one disease process. You know, mitochondria really are the signature of a multicellular life. That's, you know, that's what started it all. So it's tied into everything. It's tied into the way that all of our bioenergetics work. So you're not just benefiting one disease process. It's not like a drug where you take it for, you know, one thing. It works across the board. And I guess from your perspective, this is probably sort of the holy grail of medicine, where you have something that's free, easy to do, it feels nice, and it's going to beneficially affect all of your patients, regardless of their condition.
Yeah, I mean, and add to that, no supply chain needed. These are really important aspects of medicine, especially what's come to light, you know, here recently, where we have supply chain issues with all of the storms that we're having here in the United States. Currently, right now, one of our IV fluid factories produces 60% of the IV fluids in the United States is offline because of the hurricane that just went through North Carolina. So supply chain issues are a real issue. And let's face it, with the sun, we don't have a lot of supply issues, even in Stockholm in the wintertime. The sun does peak, and when it does come up above that horizon, there are benefits to be had.
How do you incorporate this knowledge in your practice now? It's quite clear that we've really done away with the incandescent bulb. That seems more or less done for at the moment. And people are not able to access these long wavelength lights when they're indoors. And the reality is most people actually do need to spend quite an appreciable amount of time inside working. So it's quite difficult to actually replace and replenish the light that we'd normally be getting basically from sun up to sundown. And then we'd usually have, you know, a fire by the camp that you'd be, you know, bathed in long wavelength light as well. So, you know, what's your sort of general advice to your patients with regard to restoring their relationship with long wavelength light?
So there are people, there's two groups of people. There are people that are not going to have a problem medically with getting outside into the sunlight. These are people who are typically, not white, for lack of a better term. These are darker skinned people, maybe even tan already. They don't have issues with the sun. They get outside. These are the ones that I'm not as concerned about. I would recommend to them getting outside at least 20 minutes a day whenever they can. I'll explain why I say 20 to 30 minutes. And I'll just say it's because of a lot of the data. And some of the data is out of Glenn Jeffrey's laboratory at University College London that shows that they can make these changes in the mitochondria with just 15 minutes of light. And these effects can last days in a number of situations. The other type of group of people are the people that are sensitive to the sun and ultraviolet light. They burn easily. They've had cancers in the past. They want to try to avoid skin cancer, nobly so. I don't want them to get skin cancer. And, you know, we do know, albeit our dissing of reductionistic medicine, we understand that the energy in light that is necessary to cause mutations in the DNA and cause cancer are going to be towards the ultraviolet end of that spectrum, all right? That's higher energy. But on the other hand, that higher energy ironically, does not penetrate as deeply and as well. So that ultraviolet light has a harder time getting through the atmosphere. What does that mean? That means you're going to have less ultraviolet light early in the morning, later in the evening. So that will be, those would be the best times to go outside. That atmosphere is not as good at preventing near-infrared radiation from coming in, so it's good. Clothing, covering up, wearing a broad-rim hat. These are all things that are also beneficial in terms of blocking ultraviolet light. Again, the type of light that has more energy that can cause mutations. And also a skin block. Now, there's some controversy on skin block and sunscreen for two reasons. We don't understand exactly how well it's used. And if my understanding is if you were to actually use sunblock in the way that it's tested, it's like they lather that on and they put it on every 20 yeah. minutes. It's nobody yeah. does, in other words, what they're doing. So whatever SPF is on the bottle, you're getting less than that if you're using it casually like everybody else does. But the other thing is that realize that this stuff gets absorbed, right? It gets absorbed into your body. And so to the degree that there are chemicals in those substances, we don't know what the long-term effects of those chemicals are. Obviously, there's some zinc oxide formulations, which I think we have a little bit more knowledge about, maybe actually beneficial. So the point is, what I'll say about sunblock is that you can put that on if you're concerned about ultraviolet radiation. If you're concerned about ultraviolet radiation and skin damage, I'd recommend covering up, going outside in the morning time, early in the morning before 10 o'clock, and then maybe after 4, you know, depending on the level of the sunlight. And you can get that benefit. I would recommend getting out again for at least 15, 20 minutes, again, because of that data that we see from the lab that shows that mitochondrial function is changed after about 15 to 20 minutes of good, bright sunlight, you know, 100,000 lux sunny day type of thing. Longer if it's a cloudy day. But this is the thing, is that if you have a cloudy day, hopefully in the next 2 to 3 days, you don't have a cloudy day and you can get that benefit that lasts maybe another 2 to 3 days based on the data that's coming in.
I think the beauty of the work that Scott Zimmerman and Bob Fosbury and Glenn Jeffrey are doing together is that you actually don't need to be directly exposed to the sunlight. And this is actually quite beneficial for a lot of people with pale skin who have migrated to places where the UV content is higher than it would be for their skin type, than would be best for their skin type. So, you know, being able to just put a long sleeve shirt on and a broad rim hat, you can get the long wavelength light. It goes straight through. You don't have to worry about direct exposure, but just being outside around natural surfaces will give you all of the benefits of those long wavelengths without having to be directly exposed, which I think overcomes a massive barrier for most people not wanting to directly expose their skin. It's, you know, the idea of just go outside. You don't need to be directly in the sun. You don't need to be naked. Just go outside and get, you know, go for a bushwalk. Even you're under the canopy, all of that near infrared light is bouncing around and going through your clothes into your body where it's having those beneficial effects. I think it's a really powerful thing to let people know that you don't have to be sunbathing to get all the benefits of the sun. And the beauty of near infrared light is that it bounces around through the clouds so that even on a cloudy day, you're still getting bathed in that long wavelength light. And it really lowers the barrier of entry for most people when you're trying to talk to them about sort of rewiring their mitochondria back to the way that they should be functioning.
Yeah, and Cameron, you mentioned there too about bushwalking, and I would just mention again for people to understand is that green leaves, bushes, grass, plants, these are very highly reflective of infrared light. So you're going to get a lot more infrared light on a sunny day if you're walking in a green space than if you're not walking in a green space. And it wouldn't seem like you're getting that much more light, but again, this is not light that you can see. It's not light that you're going to see, but it's light that you can sometimes feel. Again, it's the reason why on a warm summer day that the coolest place in the garden is under a tree. It's because all of that light is being reflected away. It's also the reason why when you feel those leaves, you go out and feel different objects on a hot summer day. You know, put your hand on the picnic table. Put your hand on the metal siding of the house. That's going to be hot. Touch the leaf of a tree. It's going to be very cool. And it's because it's reflecting that light that heats things up. And it's also the reason why we put glass on buildings now that are highly reflective of infrared light. It's also the reason why you're not going to get that infrared light if you're inside. And that's really the key here. I recently gave a TEDx talk in Boston about a week ago, talking about exactly what we're talking about right now. And I titled the talk about longevity and fighting chronic disease. And the byline of the talk was, let's take this fight outside. It's kind of a euphemism for, you know, hey, let's get down and dirty, let's take this outside. But really, that's what it is. If you really want to fight chronic disease, you need to take the fight outside.
How do you implement these ideas in an ICU type situation where I guess people stand to benefit the most from being exposed to these long wavelength lights? I know we have work out of Brazil showing that people who are exposed to long wavelength light during their stay are much more likely to leave days earlier than people who aren't. And I know that I think it's out of England that people who have a window facing the sun their stays tend to be significantly shorter than people who don't have windows. So how do we sort of integrate this into a hospital setting? Because I know hospitals are really the worst place to be as far as getting long wavelength light.
Yeah, and just a little bit of a history on that. It didn't used to be that way. Back in the 1920s, we built hospitals with the primary focus in mind was to make sure the patients had adequate lighting and adequate air. They even built hospitals up in the Pacific Northwest of the United States where we don't get a lot of sunlight. They used to have solariums, and the patients would come inside under these glass roofs and try to get sun in the wintertime, and then in the summertime, these windows would open up. There's old photographs that I've seen of where they would design these decks where the beds could be moved outside. It's something that we did and we understood it, but I think we started to become modern and we started doing randomized controlled trials, which are good, and on medications. And so these were new ways of treating the disease. And instead of seeing them as an adjunct, to seeing them as something that we could add on to the body of knowledge that we already had, there was a switch. And so now hospitals were now built not around the patient, but around the delivery of care. And so it was easier for the nurses to get to the patients. It wasn't an extreme understanding or a priority to get patients outside into the sun or the light. And so now what we have is we have hospitals that are all built recently in the last 50 years or sooner that are up to code in terms of energy efficiency, that are up to code in terms of earthquakes. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get people who really cannot leave their hospital bed to get outside into the sunlight. Fortunately, we are still able to get people who are, for instance, on the medical floor, or the acute floor, or the step down, you know, into a wheelchair and perhaps wheel them outside. That's still something that we can do very easily. But for the patients who are very sick, requiring high levels of oxygen therapy, it's difficult, very difficult to get them out of the bed. Sometimes they're unstable. Just moving them can cause their heart rates to change. They may even code. In that Brazilian study, they did not use any commercial product, but they did construct from scratch. It's really quite impressive. A jacket that they could put on the patient that had these LED bulbs. And I say LED, we've been talking about LED bulbs previously that only give out in the visible spectrum. That's for lighting. But you can make LED bulbs emit off at any frequency really that you would want to. And that's what they did here. This was at 940 nanometers, and it was giving off that light to the skin. This is not a light that you can see. So they either switched it on or off. So it was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. And as you had alluded to, these patients were discharged 4 days sooner than their counterparts. Not only just, you know, why were they discharged 4 days sooner? Well, there was multiple effects that were seen. Just like you had mentioned, if you fix the underlying energy problem in the body, you're going to see multiple evidences of improvement. So their oxygen saturation improved higher and faster. They were able to take deeper breaths and stronger breaths. Their heart rates and respiratory rates improved more quickly. Even their immune system, specifically the lymphocytes, and realize that the lymphocytes are really the cells that are tasked to getting rid of infected cells in the body. And whereas the control group continued to lose lymphocytes, the intervention group that got this infrared light actually had higher levels of lymphocytes, and they were recovering faster. And again, we mentioned about the days of discharge. And just to put that in perspective, we have in this country a medication called Tamiflu, which is actually FDA approved for the use of the flu. And the basis upon which that medicine got FDA approval was that it ended flu symptoms 24 hours faster than the control group. So just the symptoms themselves, 24 hours faster. What we're talking about here is 4 days difference in terms of hospitalization. Now, for a patient who is being hospitalized with COVID-19, we're talking thousands of dollars a day that the hospital is spending to keep that patient hospitalized. The hospital is going to want to do anything it can to reduce hospital days. Most hospitals, at least here in the United States, are paid based on something called a DRG. And a DRG is where if a patient comes into the hospital and they have a specific diagnosis, the insurance or the government will pay that hospital a specific fee that's based upon that diagnosis. So really, the incentive is placed on the hospital to get that patient faster, better, faster, so that they can leave and the hospital can save that extra money that they would have been spending on that patient. So if patients are there, they're not getting well faster, they're taking a lot of time, that they're going to exceed their DRG and they're actually going to be costing the hospital money as opposed to making it. So there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about the relationship between pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, and physicians. So I just want to make that clear that really, if hospitals were to understand, and the hospitals that do understand this issue are really going to be at the forefront of change. If they could only understand that getting their patients out into sunlight is going to make their whatever issue they have in the hospital heal faster, there's potentially millions of dollars of savings in this regard. I mean, 4 days faster, that would be almost unheard of. That's like at the level of antibiotics for a disease versus no antibiotics for a disease. So it's really a game changer.
I imagine if you extrapolated that out over every hospital in the United States, you might even be talking about billions of dollars. I'm sure the yes. taxpayers would be very happy about saving that money and putting it elsewhere. Something that comes through quite clearly in Glenn Jeffrey's work is that not only are the long wavelengths seem to be extremely beneficial, which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, but the lighting that we're using today, the narrow band emission in the short wavelength visible light, is nefarious. So you've got this sort of dual insult, as you don't have the good stuff, but you've got this really unnatural concentration of quite powerful, high energy photons in the visible. And you're exposed to that for an extended period of time, you don't get erythema. So you don't get, the reddening of the skin like you would if you're under, UV light to tell you, hey, you've had enough, maybe time to go sit in the shade. So what do you see as the contribution of artificial light in disease in general? I mean, we know it's having negative impacts on mitochondrial bioenergetics. So it's kind of doing the opposite of what the near infrared and infrared portion is doing. It's sort of affecting all disease processes potentially negatively. Is that the way that you see it?
Yes, I am aware of Glenn Jeffrey. I think he says that red light, he puts it simply, red light charges the battery, blue light drains the battery. And I think one thing that people need to understand to put this in perspective, maybe we should back up a little bit and talk about the mitochondria a little bit, so they understand. So this is an organelle that is in the cell that produces ATP, and there is something called the mitochondrial theory of aging, whereas as you get older, it is proposed that 70% of the energy output from the mitochondria decrease. And this is the reason why we have chronic diseases as we get older, things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, dementia, inflammation, cancer, long COVID, all of these are related to that. Why is this happening? Well, if you were to think about the mitochondria as like an engine in your car, the engine makes locomotion, but in the process of doing that, it makes heat. And if that heat is not dealt with, it can make the engine inefficient and make it shut down. And that's the same thing that goes on, except the heat in the mitochondria is oxidative stress. So sometimes oxidative stress is good if you're trying to kill infections, but in the cell generally, oxidative stress is not good because it makes the engine more inefficient. And in doing so, it becomes crippled and puts out less energy. So what you really want are systems in place that reduce oxidative stress. And one of the major ways of doing that is by producing antioxidants in the area of the mitochondria, sort of like the cooling system of an engine, if you will. So one of the major effectors of that, as we're finding out, is infrared light. Now, infrared light can penetrate very deeply, as we talked about. It can go through the skin, deep down into the cells, and scatter as well. A lot of times people will look up, you know, is it really true that infrared light can penetrate that deeply? And they'll find some numbers in the literature that are in millimeters, but the what they're measuring there is the straight light source. They're not measuring when it bounces, and it keeps bouncing and bouncing until, as Glenn Jeffrey talks about, some weak absorber is going to absorb that, and it does. There's a great photograph that Bob Fosbury, I don't know if you've seen this photograph, it's with his hand in front of an infrared light source being taken a picture of by an infrared camera filter. And you can clearly see that the light is coming through in straight lines, even through the thickness of his hand, which of course is certainly a lot more than a few millimeters, unless of course he's Flat Stanley. That's a reference to a child's book there. I don't know if you know Flat Stanley, but so clearly this light is able to penetrate through linearly through the hand. Imagine what it does after it scatters. So Scott Zimmerman, Russell Reiter, who published that paper in 2019, basically proposing, based on other people's work and evidence, that this infrared light seems to be causing the upregulation of melatonin in the mitochondria. Melatonin, of course, is one of the most powerful antioxidants known to man. It actually upregulates glutathione itself. So that's where we are in terms of the mitochondria. Now, if we're in a situation where we have blue light without red light, blue light, as you mentioned, is higher energy. It's going to have photons with higher energy, and that might be causing the creation of this oxidative stress. So blue light causes oxidative stress. Red light actually causes the production potentially of melatonin and other substances. We're going to leave that open-ended because we don't know all of the data there. But we do know what we can observe, and what we can observe clearly is that red light applied to a human being has the effect of upregulating significantly mitochondrial ATP output, which is anti-aging. And it restores a lot of the deficits that we see as people get older. The two examples from that laboratory, of course, was when they applied red light in a randomized fashion to healthy subjects. It increased mitochondrial function so much so that there was an actual reduction in glucose when people were given a 75-gram bolus of glucose. And then the paper that he published actually prior to that was in human beings that were older that had visual acuity problems with color, which is related to the mitochondrial function in the retina. Just shining for 3 minutes, red light into the retina was able to change that visual acuity for days. They were able to see much better objectively testing that. And this is not just in humans. This is seen conserved in multiple species all the way down to bees. Okay, so honeybees, they have the same effect. The mitochondria works very similarly there as well. And so I do believe that this light that we are subjecting ourselves to is a relatively new thing. Before 100 years ago, probably before 50 years ago, all of the light that we were ever experiencing was from a natural process, whether it was fusion from the sun, whether it was the combustion of oils and hydrocarbons in terms of a flame, or the lighting up of a tungsten element. There was a broad natural spectrum of light that was being produced. With fluorescent bulbs and LEDs, now we're able to curtail that and give just light in a very narrow band of area without the rest of it. And here we get into exactly the issues that we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, which is when we start to do reductionism and start to use elements without things that they're normally packaged with in nature. So now when that happens, you know, all bets are off in terms of what the effects are going to be on human beings. And I think we're starting to see those effects.
So with this light story that we're talking about, there's sort of two sides of the same coin, and we've got these sort of direct effects with the impact wavelengths certain wavelengths have on biological function. And then we've got sort of the circadian story, this light-dark cycle that we're exposed to. And a researcher at Monash University, Sean Kane, published a paper essentially questioning whether hospital lighting is breaking the Hippocratic Oath that they made as doctors, because the lighting is so pernicious and nefarious in the times that people are exposed to it, that it's potentially causing really dangerous circadian disruption when people need the strongest circadian rhythms in the hospital. And I was wondering what your opinions are on how impactful our circadian disruption in the modern world is on disease processes.
It's horrible. And it's even worse than that, because we know that let's look at the modern ICU. Okay. We've got patients that are in this intensive care unit all the time. Most of the time, they need to have their vitals checked every 2 to 4 hours. Sometimes if they're there for neurological conditions, they're having it checked every hour. Neuro checks every hour is not an uncommon situation. And so these patients are never really allowed to sleep. We know for shift workers that work at night, they ideally should be having their day at night and their night during the day, which means that the lighting at their job should be very bright, and it should be reinforcing of a reverse circadian rhythm for them. And they should be going home to a very dark bedroom and sleeping in a very dark bedroom. Unfortunately, that's not good for the patients where there's bright lights in the working areas of these healthcare workers in these ICUs to be walking into rooms that are very, very dark. And so there's always a bleeding in of that light that's never 100%. So it's going to be difficult to really get perfection in terms of what we really need. And what we really need and what the body really needs is something that is very similar to what we would have experienced 100 or 200 years ago on a desert island. We need to have bright light when it's time to have bright light and when the sun is up, and we need to have complete darkness when it's time to go to sleep. Any deviation from that ideal is going to cause less than ideal health. We have plenty of data that shows that light pollution at night, bright light at night shuts down melatonin production, not in the mitochondria, but in the pineal gland, which is then secreted into the blood circulation. There's plenty of data that is suggestive that breast cancer, blood cancers are related to situations where our immune system is not working well because of shutdowns of that circadian rhythm because of light at night. So that's a real problem. What we're now finding out is that not getting enough light during the day is also a problem. So I don't know how it is in Stockholm, but I can tell you in the United States, 93%, I think in Great Britain, it's 92%. Let's just say the majority of our time is spent inside. We are now no longer exposed to infrared light at all because of the disappearance of the incandescent light bulb and because of windows that we put on our homes that block that infrared light out. So the only way that we're going to get that, I mean, we can decide to fight if you want legislation to allow incandescent bulbs. I think that's going to be an uphill battle. Not saying that we shouldn't do it, not saying that we shouldn't be informing our manufacturers of light bulbs what they should be doing. But if you want to get change immediately, the fastest way to do that is to stand up, walk over to the door, use your hand to turn the handle, and to simply walk outside and make that part of your routine, to be doing things on a regular basis outside. If that means moving into an area where that is more conducive, or fixing up your backyard so that it's something that you're more likely to do, or making it a point to eat outside in the morning, I think, just like everything else, we decide to change our behaviors to go to the gym because we want to, you know, have a better physique. This is one of the most simplest interventions that anybody could possibly do. We're simply asking for people to go outside, even if it's a cloudy, rainy day, even if it's a cold day. Going outside is going to allow you to get more light than you could ever get inside your home. And to do it for just 15 to 20 minutes every day, I think that's it's a small ask, but I believe it can actually have a big impact. Let me explain to you why I believe that's the case. I actually think there's some interventional data to that. We don't have data that shows that people going outside for 15 to 20 minutes a day and doing nothing else is actually going to improve it. But we have something very similar to that. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was a study that was just wrapped up and published out of a number of studies that they're doing in Louisville, Kentucky. This is an area where they planted, after measuring the blood tests and checking for the high sensitivity CRP, which is a surrogate for strokes and heart attacks, they planted 8,000 mature trees, which of course are highly reflective of infrared light, in a 4-square-mile area in Louisville, Kentucky. That's all they did. And why is this important? There has been data for years that green space data, people that are in green spaces, have lower blood pressures, lower diastolic blood pressure, less stress, less preterm labor. I mean, the benefits go on and on and on. They even have lower urinary cortisol levels, which means less stress, okay? So they planted 8,000 plus mature trees, right? So we're not waiting for them to grow up. They are being planted with the leaves already on the tree. 2 to 3 years later, they go out and they remeasure the same population. CRP levels drop by 13%. That's all. There was no campaign to get them out to exercise. There was no campaign to get them outside. It's simply that when they were outside, they were probably getting more infrared light from the trees from the very fact that they were there. Why is this an important finding? Because for years, even though we've known that people do better in green spaces, the critics would bring up the confounders that, well, people who live in green spaces are typically better off socioeconomically. They tend to exercise more. How do we know that? Is it the green space that's doing anything? Or is it the fact that we're dealing with different people than those that are not and can't afford to live in green spaces? A legitimate argument, but I think this really puts the exclamation point on our side of the ledger saying, look, we did not change their socioeconomic status. We did not do a campaign to get them out and exercise more. All we did is literally plant trees. That's all we did. And that had an impact on people who were spending 93% of their life in the house. So imagine if they were to increase the amount of time that they spent outside and there was the green trees. I think your figure of billions of dollars may not be too far off. This is really probably out of all of the interventions that we can do on a public basis, I cannot think of a more profitable intervention, an easier intervention, something that doesn't require a supply chain. It's generally free. I don't know of anything else that can beat this. And that's why I've continued to talk about it. I'm interested in it. Obviously, you're interested in it. I think this is a very tantalizing and intriguing concept. And what's standing in our way? It's people to believe that something so simple can do something so well. And it's this, of course, this inbred error of thinking that we've had for so long that the sun is a deadly laser, okay? That it's our enemy. And this is a... This is something that I think we need to sort of rethink. In fact, Dr. Richard Weller, who I'm sure you know, he's a dermatologist there in the UK. He just recently submitted a paper and it was published in a major dermatological journal called the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. And the name of his paper is called Sunshine, Time for a Rethink. And he's bringing up exactly the same points that we are.
I think that story about the planting of the trees, no other intervention other than planting trees can have such a remarkable effect. It just shows how starved our bodies are for long wavelength light, that such a small intervention can have such a disproportionate effect. And, you know, coming from a blue zone, how much of the story about blue zones would you attribute to the fact that these people are spending more time outside? I know there are a lot of complex things going on. You know, they have close familial relationships. They stay active later in life. They're given meaning throughout their entire lives. You know, a lot of things going on with regard to the blue zones. But one thing I never hear is this sunlight story that we're talking about. What kind of role do you think that's actually playing in people living longer?
Oh, I definitely think it definitely is playing a role. We don't even have to look at blue zones, although we'll come back to that. A couple of big epidemiological studies, of course, very close to you there in Stockholm, is the Sweden study that looked at about, 30,000 women over 20 years. And it showed that the women that, first of all, it divided them up into three groups: those that were avidly seeking the sun, those that had moderate sun exposure, and those that avoided the sun. And it was a stepwise function. Those, the more categories, the more that you went to the category of avidly seeking the sun, the lower the incidence was as all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, non-cardiovascular mortality, even cancer mortality. When it included skin cancer, it was still lower. In fact, the authors noted this, and I think it was just incredible, that that women, Swedish women that avoided the sun, okay, and didn't smoke, had the same mortality as Swedish women who did smoke and avidly went after the sunlight. I thought that was just to give you the magnitude of what we're talking about. And then I thought about, of course, what we've been doing here for years here in California is sending smokers outside to smoke. We actually may be doing them a favor. We should probably be going for our non-smoking break to really get that kind of benefit. But interestingly, that study of 30,000 Swedish women was repeated recently in a UK biobank study, 10 times as many people, both men and women, same findings, exactly the same findings, reduction in all-cause mortality. But you're talking about blue zones. So the original blue zones were Sardinia, Okinawa, Loma Linda, where, of course, I've grown up. And we definitely get outside. There's been some question marks about the birth certificates and things. None of that has affected the status of Loma Linda. Loma Linda is in California. California has been keeping track of birth certificates since 1905, well over 100 years. So I have no doubt. And I know it personally. My next door neighbor was a surgeon. He passed away, but he was assisting with cardiac surgeries over the age of 100. And he didn't look over 100. So these people, it's not just sunlight. If you really wanted to put it together for those that are interested, and actually there's a university here in California called Weimar University that employs a lot of what I'm about to say. It's the 8 simple rules. So growing up in Loma Linda as a Seventh-day Adventist and reading some of the things that we espouse, if you wanted to make a mnemonic and put it together, the 8 pillars of health, it would spell out something called New Start, N-E-W-S-T-A-R-T. So these are these. If you want to know what the recipe is, what are the ingredients of a long and longevity life, at least as we follow it in Loma Linda and other places where Adventists live, New Start would be the recipe. And it stands for N is nutrition. And of course, we believe in a plant-based diet, generally speaking. In fact, we could go and talk about the Adventist Health Study, where interestingly, the majority of the people in that study were actually eating meat, which made it a great study because we were able to eliminate the healthy user effect of tobacco, alcohol, and all of these things, which we completely eliminated. So now you're just literally looking at diet, and the best performing group in that subgroup analysis was the vegan, followed by the vegetarian, followed by the pesco-vegetarian, followed by the omnivore. So nutrition. That's the N for New Start. E, exercise. So when I say exercise, you know, what flashes in your mind? You're thinking about a 24-hour fitness commercial with these highly toned bodies and these people that are working out and they're doing... No, that's not the exercise that I'm talking about. Actually, Jennifer Heiss out of the Fit Lab in Ontario, Canada, did a great study where she looked at no exercise versus moderate exercise versus high intensity exercise. Guess which one of those three had the best outcomes in terms of depression, the least inflammatory cytokine markers. Guess which one? it was moderate exercise. So we're talking about going out and gardening. We're talking about walking. We're not talking about, you know, going to an extreme, because that actually can actually weaken your immune system. So moderate exercise. Okay, the W, that's water. Sometime you have to have me on. We can talk about the effects of water, not only internally, but also externally, in terms of sauna and steam sauna, in terms of hydrotherapy, and what that does to the innate immune system with interferon, and how that affects people who are infected with influenza, SARS-CoV-2. And actually, that goes along with what hospitals used to do back 100 years ago when they were out there getting fresh air and sunlight. When they were inside, what was going on inside? Hydrotherapy was going on inside, because that was activating the innate immune system. And we have some data. It's not perfect data. It's not randomized controlled data. It's retrospective data that actually shows that it was probably 6 times better than what was going on in the Army hospitals during the pandemic. So that's N-E-W. S-T-A-R-T. What does that stand for? Well, the S stands for what we've been talking about today, sunlight. And huge benefits there. The literature that we have followed here at Loma Linda and other places is that getting outside into nature, getting outside into the sunlight, getting outside where the trees are, is really, really beneficial. So that's the S. The T stands for temperance. So this is not going to be a surprise to you, but, you know, abstaining from things like alcohol, tobacco, drugs. This doesn't sound very, you know, earth-shattering, but I'll tell you, when this stuff was written back in the 1800s, it was written at a time when physicians were prescribing cigarettes for patients with lung ailments. So this sort of went against the standard medical therapy at the time, but we followed it for over 100 years. And obviously, smoking is probably one of the single biggest risk factors for cancer right now, whether it's lung cancer, kidney cancer, throat cancer, a whole bunch of cancers. So that's obviously a major foundational mark. The A in S-T-A-R-T stands for air. Getting outside into the air, we could talk about the benefits not only of having fresh air devoid of toxins inside of a building. And, you know, Joseph Allen has made a career at Harvard Medical School, Harvard School of Public Health, looking at sick buildings. He's the one that coined the term sick buildings, forever chemicals. These are the things that are associated with being inside. So opening your windows, allowing ventilation to occur, carbon dioxide going out and allowing fresh air. There could be a lot to be said about getting rid of those negatives, but it's not just getting rid of the negatives, but also adding the positives. So what do I mean by that? We know clinically, scientifically, and the Japanese have done a lot of work on this, that when you're out in nature, there are something called phytoncides that are released from trees that can interact when we breathe them in and actually can stimulate our immune system. So eucalyptus oil has been tested extensively on this. We've actually done a med cram on what they call forest bathing. It sounds kind of woo-woo, but there actually is science to it. When you apply eucalyptus oil to a petri dish of cells, you can demonstrate very easily that the phagocytic nature of those cells, the ability to eat foreign objects, is greatly enhanced. That's with eucalyptus. They also did studies on the Hinoki cypress tree, which is a plant indigenous to Japan. They did a number of studies where they took CEOs from Tokyo out into the forest, and then they compared what it was like in the city. So a lot of research, good data there in terms of fresh air, not only avoiding the bad, but also getting the good. The R, that stands for rest. So under rest is sleep. And boy, we have had an explosion of data in the last 20, 30 years telling us that, yes, the hours before midnight are more beneficial in terms of sleep. Yes, getting 7 hours of sleep is beneficial. So clearly we have data on a daily rest. I think where Seventh-day Adventists sort of notch it up a little bit more is they're very keen on a weekly rest. And there's something to be said for that. You know, if you think about the fact that every single culture in the world, however isolated they were, they are all on a 7-day week, all of them, without exception, every single one, even though there's no astronomical planetary body associated with it. Like, for instance, the Earth spins around in 1 day, Okay, that's obvious. The Earth goes around the sun in 365 days. That makes sense. A month, that's the cycle that it takes for the moon to go around once and you have it. There's nothing astronomically that has to do with a week, yet it seems as though, and there's actually some research on this, that we have a biorhythm that resets every 7 days. And so taking a day out of that seven and simply resting from the work that we do during the week, daily grind in and out, that one day that allows us to say, stop, let's reset, let's take stock of where we are, where are we going? Are we going in the right direction? Do we need to make changes? Can we recharge? I think this has a tremendous benefit on our outlook, and it allows us to be balanced. So that's the R. And then finally, the T. The last T is probably the last frontier in terms of science, because it's the area of science, it's the area that science has not really nailed down as well as it should, but it's starting to. And that is trust in a higher power, trust in God. There's a lot of data that's coming out that shows that people that have faith, people that can rest, they have less anxiety. And we see that in those situations, in the right situations, that can actually be very beneficial. That would be where I would say community falls, because if you're with people who believe the same way as you do, and that can also be very reinforcing. Now, there's also data that shows that if you're in abusive relationships in terms of religion, that could be negatively impacted. So it's got to be the right type of relationship, the right type of higher power. And so really that's, I think, everything right there. Those are the eight pillars. And I think that's the secret sauce. There's nothing about Southern California there. There's nothing about a particular race there. This is something that can be applied anywhere. I do concede that, you know, it's in Stockholm in December. It's hard to get that first S. You got to work at it, but you can do it. With modern technology and the purchase of a $20 satellite from Amazon, which is not too expensive. That's the one thing I think that might be beneficial. 20 minutes in the morning, 11 to 15 inches from your head every single day significantly reduces the incidence of seasonal affective disorder. And I think that's something that would be beneficial. But all of these things are really accessible. They're not expensive. It's something that everybody can do.
That sounds like such a great way to end. We will have to do another episode together, because I didn't even get to ask you anything about pulmonary science in general, which I'm very interested in, by the way. But I think we'll leave it there. I would love to have you back on, and we can do a part two, because there's so much more that needs to be said. And I must admit, it is so refreshing to hear a doctor talk about these things that do sound more esoteric and do sound a bit woo-woo. But the reality is, like you said, there's such an incentive to employ these things, because not only can we help people dramatically, we actually save the taxpayers money in an enormous way as well. So it's sort of an everybody wins type situation just by, like you said, opening the door and walking outside. It's extremely refreshing to hear someone who's in your position talking about these things that are so easy and so simple to implement. And it's great that you have such a platform to do so as well. It makes me very, very pleased and honored to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much, Cameron. You know, I always love talking about these things, because I know that it can actually make a difference in people's lives. I've seen it in my own patients. And, you know, who knows who would be watching this podcast later that would be benefited from it. We may never know.
Butterfly effect is real. Even if it just affects one person, we have no idea how much that can affect into the future. So thank you so much for giving me some of your time. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. I've left links to Roger's YouTube channel, MedCram, in the episode notes if you'd like to check it out. He has a few fantastic long-form videos on the effects of red light therapy that are extremely interesting. I've also left links to all of my platforms if you'd like to keep up to date with the podcast. Again, please feel free to support my work by subscribing to my Substack. This is the best way to do that while getting access to even more information about health and science from my perspective. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.